Like Aaron said, I'm Ron Turco, and I've given this talk a few times. It gets modified every time I give it, so I've got a chunk in here about AFRI. I would echo what Aaron just said about going to hear the AFRI people today at 10 o'clock. AFRI's where it's at, and AFRI's is kind of weird, so you might want to go hear what they have to say about it. So I have some information for you in this talk. If you want the really short version, I've got that, but the AFRI program managers are here. The other thing is that when you get into your new job, I don't have this in here, I just realized this morning. USDA has grant writing workshops that are specific for new faculty, and you go for 2 days, and you have to get somebody to pay for it. It's a little bit pricey, but your experimentation director or whoever can pay for it for you. I put it as part of your startup package. Do one of those also when you get into whatever position you're going to get into. Okay, so that's really a critical thing to do as well. So you can sort of meet the program managers, you can get their feel for things, you can kind of understand their viewpoint on things. Okay, so one of my colleagues here, Leslie Oliver, one of the first authors on this, we sort of put this little slide together. And so what do you get when you cross a Kentucky Wildcat and a Purdue Boilermaker, a very weird animal? You get a similar perspective. You need grant money. And that's really what this talk is about. I hate to be so nitty-gritty about things in terms of what this is really about, but it's really about money. It's really about money and support for your program. Okay, and it's not, there's nothing fancy about it. There's a higher goal in mind, but the process of doing this is very, 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 very much work-related. You got to do it. Grants are what we do. We'll always do what you need to do to learn to do. That's a bad sentence. But if you want to start and then stay in academic research, you have no choice, okay? You have no choice in this. You've got to learn how to do proposals and grants. It's mandatory. You're going to hate it for a while, then it becomes sort of obsessive, and then you get good at it, and it's not so bad, okay? But it takes a while. It takes a while to get going. Just yesterday morning, very bizarrely, we don't usually get announcements of this kind of stuff on Sundays, but a friend of mine at Purdue received word from AFRI that she had received a $5 million grant. And she is just became an associate professor, I mean like last semester. So, and she is, you know, very excited, as you might imagine. But she has worked this plan like we have, I'm going to go through here, pretty hard in order to get to that point. She has done everything right in terms of smaller grants, publications, citing herself, workshops, exposure, going out and seeing people, getting to be known, all that kind of stuff. And she's done all that background and work to get that to the point she's at. So she's done very well in 6 years, so it's pretty good. So they don't normally announce this on Sunday, but she opened her email up yesterday morning, and it was like, congratulations, you have received, you're the lead PI on a $5 million grant. She said, that was a good morning. And then the emails from everybody else I started. Well, when can I get my money? Because it's a multi investigator proposal. So I'll talk about that in a second too. Okay. So what are your motivations for writing proposals? You get support. Support for. That's really what the key here is. Answering a fundamental question. Okay. Solving a problem. So you can actually solve a problem with a grant. You can go out and someone's got some issue, you can get a grant to work on it, some water flow issue, for example. And then the little more higher goal of transferring knowledge to this and the next generation. So those are the kind of, so the way I look at it, and sort of three overarching motivations for grant writing. The more practical level, okay, promotion, prestige, students, publication, admiration, and you get to get more grants. Okay? That's a little more on the practical side. And it's sort of a mixture of these two columns that really drive all this. So as you will go through your career, your first position, how many people are assistant professors or starting out? Are you guys all grad students? Well, Aaron's assistant, but he's not really starting out. You guys all grad students, postdocs? Okay. So you're on the way kind of down the road to the golden arches of academic success as an assistant professor. So finding ideas for proposals is really the first step. Right? What's your idea? The value of an idea lies in using it, okay? That's Thomas Edison. You guys know he was pretty successful. And then I have Picasso's quote, which is, I begin with an idea and I become something else. If you guys have ever seen Picasso's work, you'd kind of understand that. I have an example of that right there. And then this is, I think, really important here. Proposals give your life to your ideas, okay? They really give life to your ideas. That's your mental construction of something. It's really what happens. You can crystallize that. And a really good example of that is, you guys probably don't know who, some of you might, who Lee Iacocca is. He was the guy who initially had the plans for the Mustang, Ford Mustang. He worked for Ford Motor Company, and in 1964 came up with the idea for the Ford Fastback. And since then, I had to look this up, since 1964 they've sold 8 million Mustangs. Okay, that's a pretty good idea, proposal to idea to success, right? So he wrote a proposal initially for that. And it's the same thing. You're going to write a proposal for somebody, it's some huge success that might occur. Action is the foundational key to all success. Okay, and this is the reality step slide. Okay, you're in grad school, you're a postdoc, you are or were challenged by that. Things you might need to know. Where you go for a job, the state is not going to provide you support. Okay? Your new school is going to provide you a little bit of cash. Aaron, give you a little bit of cash when you came into Purdue. Are we giving you any more? No. See, I brought an example. Make sure you get your startup straightened out. Okay? And then there's a session on interview stuff. That's today or tomorrow? This afternoon. You should go to that, listen to how to do the negotiation. That's really important. Don't get yourself screwed there. You need to negotiate yourself a few things. There are more people looking for money, and I have an economist friend who gives me this quote. He gave me a quote a year ago. I love it. Demand does not create supply. Okay? Just because there's a bunch more people looking for grant money doesn't mean the government's going to put any more up there. So you guys are all up against that curve where everyone's looking for the same resource. You can't rely on your major professor. You need to develop your own program. That's really critical in terms of your promotion package. And you need to have grants and publications that are on your own, sort of separate from your major professor, especially in Aaron's case. Your reality, you love research. You wouldn't be doing this if you didn't, right? And you're trained for it. So you need to develop the skills, and you need to develop the new skill of the grant skill, okay? Sort of think of it as a skill. Think of it as like doing PCR or doing extractions or looking at growth of plants or anything else. Grant skill is a different kind of thing. It's just something you got to develop. It's not something we teach a lot of in school. We have a couple classes where we require proposals. You probably wrote a proposal for your PhD package. But grant skill is something you really need to sort of think of as a separate little piece of your life and you need to work on. If you want to work and you want to build on your own ideas, you really need to develop that. Okay? It needs to be a part of your program. Don't think of it as an add-on. Think of it as a skill. Think of it as the thing at the same level as any of your research abilities you have. So it's an important thing. Proposals and managing grants are now your life, period. And faculty jobs will be all-consuming in some time period. Okay? It's just the way it is. There's a work-life session. I should go to that, I guess. I failed that. So theoretically, you should have all the time in the world to write a grant proposal. The request for proposal comes out, and you can just sit down and leisurely write the grant proposal. Well, all this stuff happens. Okay. So the RFP comes out, you get some amount of time between when that comes out and when the proposal's due, and then mixed into there, you've got the following: teaching, papers, life, family, committees, reviews, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This meeting is sitting right on top of a huge grant proposal we're working on right now. It's really an inconvenient place, and we couldn't get the society to move the meeting at such short notice. Then it becomes sort of the way I look at grant proposals, and this is really a sad thing, is how many weekends until the next proposal's due. Okay, that's sort of how we sort of dice up time steps for proposals. A few proposaling terms I want to throw out. I've used them already. I want to make sure you guys are kind of aware of them. RFAs, request for application. Okay, that's what type of grant application process. This is all on the internet. It's not anything I've made up here. Request for proposals, an RFP. Typically, an RFA gives you a grant. Typically, an RFP gives you a contract. There's a subtle difference. Basically, it comes down to how much control the agency is going to exert on you. So, a contract tends to have more involvement with whoever gave you the money. A grant tends to have less involvement with whoever gave you the money. Your goal is to get a grant. I'll tell you, first things. Contracts can be kind of a pain. So depending on the agency, depending on what's going on, you can get a grant or a contract. And in reality, you'll be happy with either one, and you'll work with either one. But one of them is a little bit better than the other. Indirect costs. Also called facilities and administrative costs, F&A, or indirect costs, is the amount your university will charge off your grant for their uses. Okay, it's a federally negotiated rate. It's what goes to pay for the phone calls, the support, the library, the building cost, everything else is what's included in indirect cost. Indirect cost at Purdue is 52% of most grants. So you do your proposal, and then you add on 52% to go to the university, some arrangement with your business people. The USDA grants are set at 25%, so it's a little different there with USDA. It's a federally controlled number, and it's negotiated at the university. You really can't you can't really get major exceptions, but you should always ask. So you get the indirect cost rate. That's the amount that the university charges. Again, it's a negotiated rate. It's based on all kinds of things. It's a federally derived. There's lawyers and accountants and all kinds of people involved with that process. The other thing I've gotten questions on over the years is some people, some grants require things like matching and cost share. Okay, matching is a required contribution of some of time or money. It's often used. Okay, so the agency says we want you to match the money you get. So if it's a 1-to-1 match or 2-to-1 or 1-to-2, that means for every dollar they give you, you got to give them a dollar of non-federal money or non-whatever money. USGS is really good at this. They want a 1-to-1 match on all the money that they give out. I don't know why. It's one of the few federal agencies that really requires it. So you have to for every dollar they give you, you've got to have a dollar of non-federal money that sort of goes onto that project. There's lots of ways of doing that, and again, it's something you should talk to your business people about. There's some fairly clever ways of getting around that. Rarely does a university actually give you any money. It's usually some kind of magic accounting procedure that they use. And then there's cost share. Cost share used to be really popular, and cost share was usually a fraction of the total grant. It was something in the 20% range, and universities hate cost share. They'll fight you on it all the time unless it's required by the grant. It's sort of this thought that if you give some money, then you're going to have better odds of getting money. But you should always look into a cost share situation on a grant with your university. Again, it varies per school, per department, per everything. So it's there. So if you see a cost share come up in a call, talk to somebody about what that exactly means. So it's kind of a critical thing. So what is a grant opportunity at the federal level? Well, there is a definition for this, and it's basically a publicly available document by which the federal agency makes known its intention to award discretionary grants or cooperative agreements, okay? And then cut to the chase on this, the federal government now uses one place for all this information, and that's grants.gov, okay? And grants.gov is the federal resource for programs. It's real simple, grants.gov. And it's where you get information from, and it's where you apply to. Okay, so it's one sort of one stop. It's advertisement and delivery. On this slide, what I'm trying to illustrate here is that you, as a new investigator, or as an old investigator in my case, need to be aware of what's out there in Opportunity Land. No one's going to really, until you get really established and people call you up, they do that occasionally. You need to sort of be aware of what's going on. So you need to check out grants.gov. You need to become part of the community of science. You need to look at other systems for seeing what's going on, Twitter, email, RSS alerts. There's all kinds of ways of getting announcements. I get a daily email on new grant announcements that are out. It comes to my, I get an email every day telling me what's available. And you have to sort of define what you want to have your information on. Otherwise, you get this big long list. But I get that from the community of science. Every day I get an email in the environmental and soils area, anything that comes out. Often I don't get anything, but sometimes I'll get a pretty good announcement. The key here is grants.gov. So don't fear grants.gov. It looks like this. I just pulled this off the other day. It's relatively functional now. A couple of years ago it wasn't. It's a pretty good resource. If you haven't ever looked at grants.gov, you should. It's if you've never and I would suggest you not mess with it other than looking at it until you actually get to wherever your job would be, and then work with your business people there. They may take care of a lot of this for you, and if they'll do that, let them. That's the other trick here that the young faculty don't always understand is if you can get someone to do your work for you, let them. Okay, so if you have a business person who is really good and really helpful, and we'll put your information up in grants.gov, and we'll work with you, let them do it. Don't fight with them. Don't argue with them. Don't think you can do it better. They can do it better. If you don't have that, then you're kind of on your own. But Didn't put his phone on vibrate. Grants.gov is not that difficult to use. There's some tricks with it. Again, you need to work with somebody who's used it before. It's also a great resource for what's out there. You can search it. It's built. It was required by federal law that it be very searchable and all the information go in there. So it's a really good resource. But take a look at it. You can't do it here because the Wi-Fi is not free. But there's lots of programs, 44 federal agencies, NSF, USDA, AFRI, EPA STAR, DOD, Department of Defense, Department of Education, Department of Energy, USGS, all provide major support in our areas, okay? NSF is probably the big one. The biggest grant support out there is NIH. It's one of the more difficult ones to get hold of. There's about $150 billion, 2010, in research money. It's hard to show you where it all is, but it's out there. And if you look through grants.gov, I did a search through grants.gov. There were 26,000 calls listed. Most were closed, but from January 2009 to now. So there's 26,000 opportunities for something or other. That's, with grants.gov, you also discover that's where they do all the things like a bid for new paint colors for buildings and windows and toilet paper and all kinds of stuff. So you have to be sort of, you have to fish through it. But that's the way the government does business is grants.gov. Okay, so you need to look at it. You need to kind of know it, how it works. Just use it as a resource until you get out there. There were, in 2009, which is kind of an odd year, but there were 309,000 submissions to grants.gov in grants area. That was a 54% increase over 2008, and that's attributable to the Recovery Act projects that were put in, okay? So typically it's around 200,000 applications a year going to grants.gov. And it will turn out that half of those are on the day you want to submit. So grants.gov will bog down. I mean, literally, it will slow down and not work. So if there's a big submission, you should look, when you do a submission time and you're thinking about submitting to grants.gov, you should see what else is submitting on that day. You can sort of see that in the information they have. And if there's a big NIH call going in that day and you're not part of it, that system will bog down. So you need to be 2 or 3 days ahead of big. If your date and a bunch of other things coincide, get ahead of that. We literally had a guy not get a proposal submitted because the system wouldn't let him in. And grants.gov, by their rules, put that back onto you. Okay? You're basically screwed if you can't get in because the system bogged down. You should have been sooner. So this is a profile of what's out there and trends in research by agencies. And you can't really see it, but the big red bar is over there under 2008. That's the recovery money. That's all gone. We've recovered apparently, so it's all that money's gone. The next bar over is this year, 2010. This is sort of the competitive dollars that are around. And the first one is all other, which is all kinds of things. The next one down, that little stack bar, is USDA. Okay. Your new life. USDA is one of the smaller federal agencies. You don't even see it on there. It's EPA. EPA is in all other. It's about $66 million in EPA dollars a year. So this is adjusted for all the other things they adjust money dollars for. But this will give you some picture of what's out there in terms of available funds. Even NSF pales in comparison to NIH. So if you really were smart, you'd get out of this business and do medical research. The NSF program, they're usually typically less than 21% success rate, and this is a bit of a trumped up number because they include conference grants in that success rate. Okay, conference grants aren't nearly as competitive, so it sort of brings their competitive numbers up, but it's less than 21% success rate for competitive proposals. Average amount is $110,000 for NSF, okay? And the mean duration is 3 years. All right. USDA AFRI NRI program, which is the old program, had about 2,000 applications in 2007. They funded, and then 2008, they funded 303 research grants were funded in 2008. And 10% went to EPSCoR states by federal law, and 1% went to new investigators. don't get too fooled by new investigator money, okay? There's some advantages and disadvantages, but usually it's less money than you get by being a regular investigator. All right, so you can declare yourself a new investigator, but don't rely on it too much. NIFA's been out. NIFA is a different game, and we have very little data on what's going on. It's starting to build up now, but it's a way different program. EPA STAR, they do a lot of things. They have $66 million, which is not very much in terms of grant dollars, and they tend to award a lot of fellowships. They award these STAR applications. They have 3,500 grant applications. They funded 200 app proposals. So again, low odds on this stuff in EPA. Other sources of money. There's lots of sources of money around. There's state monies. There's industrial monies. The state money and the industrial money are sort of similar in that a lot of times it has to do with who you know and who you're willing to work with and how you get that going. So a lot of times it's not really competitive. It's sort of semi-competitive. You know somebody needs something done. This goes back to the contract arrangement where somebody needs something done. I'm negotiating a project right now with a company. They came to me and they got a problem they got to fix, and we're negotiating how much that will cost them. So that's basically, that was not competitive at all. It's just, it's a lot of money, but it's not competitive. But they knew I worked on this area, and they were interested in getting me to help them on something. So that's highly individualized. They didn't have a call. They don't have anything. They just came in and said, here, let's talk about this. That's typical of industrial money. So with industrial money, the key thing is to know a lot of people if you want to go that route. Okay, know people in your area who work in the industry. This meeting is an okay arrangement, but if you meet people from industry, talk to them. That's the way you get industry money. It's pretty simple. It's hard, but pretty simple. A lot of states have what are called federal block and formula grants. Okay, 319 program, which I have a grant from, is a really good example of federal money that goes to the state, and the state awards it. Okay, and every state has 319 money. It's related to the Clean Water Act. And states develop their own priorities and programs and release of these converted federal funds. So there's some weird, what happens is there's some federal rules mixed with state rules, so it gets to be a little odd. But it's usually done competitively. It's usually a rule set by rules. But it does help to know who's doing what at the state level. You can also get the state creating their own programs, which Indiana's got one major grant program. It tends to take the first hit when there's a budget downturn. Foundations, I find foundations really hard to work with. I mean, I've really struggled with foundations over the years. I've submitted three or four times to foundations, and we put major grants together for major applications to foundations, and received very, very little feedback or anything else from foundations. Now, the big player in foundations now is the Gates Foundation. And the Gates Foundation is a whole different game. That foundation's on par with NIH in terms of the amount of money they have. So, and they have specific things they're interested in. They're not really that interested in basic research. They're interested in fixing stuff. I mean, literally, they want to solve a problem, and they want you to put together a team that will solve a problem. Okay, and they're talking multiple millions of dollars in this. They want to solve things like, you know, easy things like solving AIDS or world hunger or water quality issues in sub-Saharan Africa or someplace. But that's the kind of thing the Gates Foundation works with. They have a lot of money, and they're an interesting organization from that perspective. There's also lots of special purpose foundations. A lot of states have little foundations. What you'll find out, though, is if you're at a big university, your odds of getting foundation money from one of these little foundations is pretty limited. So if you're at a small university, that tends to turn around a little. They tend to favor some of the smaller schools in terms of the kind of things they support. You get community foundations. They don't like research. So they like you to go out and build something or, you know, irrigate a softball field. I don't know. Those kind of things they'll support. They don't really want to support understanding the ecological distribution of pathogenic organisms in a watershed. That's not something they're going to be interested in. There's family foundations. They're kind of a bit odd. We have a family foundation in Indiana. It's called the Lilly Foundation. It's kind of a big It's up near the Gates Foundation. It's not quite as big. And they support all kinds of things, but they tend to want to support, again, community impact things. So it's hard to get basic money out of them. So typically, the foundations typically, by history, are most interested in education. So if you can submit a grant to them to improve education or change some kind of education paradigm or change this or that or implement different technologies or approaches, that kind of thing, they'd be interested in talking to you. They like human services, they like health, and they like the arts. That's typically the breakdown of foundations. Typically, in higher education, we're seeing most of it go, the support from foundations go to education-related issues. Again, changing how teaching's done or changing how students interact, or retention of students, that kind of stuff. That's what foundations like to support at the university level. There's some very specific foundations that will support research. The Hewlett Packard Foundation, they support a lot of research, especially in California. They're really big. They're a California-based family, quote unquote, the Hewlett Packard family. They support a lot of research. Gates supports research as part of an initiative. They don't support it just straight up. They do a combo thing. Lilly supports research again, but it's not usually as a specific piece. It's part of the thing. So that's where these bigger things goes on. Okay. Now the game has changed, kids, and I don't really know what to tell you about NIFA. That's why I suggest you go to the NIFA talk at 10. NIFA used to be NRI. It used to be National Research Initiative. Okay, it used to be USDA NRI. Last year they changed everything. So NIFA is now National Institute of Food and Agriculture, and they've had some specific things on new investigators that you would be interested in this. New investigators, that would maybe be you, should apply for individual investigator grants as the project director. Okay, you should apply as a PI. Don't be fooled into anything else. Okay, and by definition, a new investigator is less than 5 years postgraduate. You have career track experience. You have no competitively awarded federal research funds. That's the critical step. No competitively awarded federal research funds makes you a new investigator for 5 years. And you should indicate that on the application, that's all. Don't get too excited about new investigator awards. The other thing that I want to emphasize here, because this is the way NIFA is going, is that new investigators probably should not apply as project director on these large team grants. Okay? These are the $5 million type. You shouldn't come out of grad school or postdoc and apply for one of those as a lead investigator. You can be part of a team, that's not a problem. And I would encourage you to do that. But the amount of stuff, that's the word I'll use, that falls from the sky on you when you're one of these project directors is tremendous. It could actually detrimentally affect your career. If you don't get it funded, then it's going to help your career. But it's one of these things that the process is not, it's not a two-way process. So new investigators, you should probably not be a project director on a larger team grants unless you have experience in doing that. Some people have done that in some past life, and that's fine. But just be careful on these things. If you see these $5 million cap projects, for example, or other projects they have, think about finding a project that's going on in your university and getting to be part of that. Don't try to lead one. Now, you can lead the individual investigator stuff just fine. And I'll come back to that in a bit here. So this is the actual proposal. I want you to think about this. You've got to follow 60 simple steps. You guys going to get them all down? Okay. It's really simple if you can get all 60 steps in the right order and the right timing involved. First thing about grant proposals. This is the stuff no one ever tells you. Time is critical, okay? Time is critical. You need to be proactive. You need time to write a persuasive proposal, okay? Do not underestimate the amount of time it takes to write a good proposal. It's a really important thing. You got to create time to produce a proposal, starting with the idea leading to the final product, and you got to take action on controlling your time. You get out there and you get your first job, I got Aaron here. Aaron's a good example. He's not really in his first job, but I'll pretend he is. You get a lot of demands on your time, don't you, Aaron? I mean, it's just like thousands of different things coming at you constantly, and you're trying to think about something, anything, not related to those thousands of things, and it doesn't happen. It's just everything comes at you when you get into a new faculty position, and that you have to create sort of this shell around yourself for certain times of the day in order to get things done that you want to get done in terms of proposals or papers for that matter, those kind of things. Time is critical. So you have to sort of control the workflow for a proposal, okay? Any proposal, if it's a team proposal, small proposal, big proposal, any kind of proposal. Things you have to control that seem to take forever are things like budgeting. Oh, that takes forever. I mean, oh, God, you got to go through thousands of iterations of it. You got to do cost share. That takes forever. Budget justification, summer salary discussions, all that takes forever. But that takes away from the actual proposal development process. That's just the stuff that gets stuck on the side of the proposal that you got to do when you're trying to write a proposal. You're trying to do the science. You're trying to do the ideas in the proposal. And someone's calling you up saying, well, how many grad students you want on this, and how much space do you have, and where are you going to do this work, you know, all that kind of stuff. You need to keep thinking that. You need to keep thinking about all these things that get added on to the time steps that are involved with the process. Approvals. If you work with animals or people, you need to get approvals. And you need to have at least preliminary approvals for a lot of that stuff in the proposal. You need to have your human subjects, if you're doing human dimensions work, you need to have your human subjects approvals in place, at least temporaries, those kind of things. If you have off-campus collaborators, you just added a whole huge time step to your life. Because everyone's time zone, even if they're in the same time zone you are, they have different time steps involved. So it's a huge amount of work. Letters of support. If you have a project that requires letters of support, for example, you better decide you're going to write them and send it to them, and they'll send them back to you modified. Don't wait on them to do that, but then you've got to do all that work too. So again, more time's involved with these things. So take control. That's what I said before. Time steps are critical. You take control of this stuff early, and you can find some help if you can, some correct help on campus, and you get some help on this stuff if you can. Now, that's not always the case. Sometimes you just end up doing this all yourself. But if you've got a budget person you can work with them. Find out where the budget person is. We have this process at Purdue now called the pre-awards office. And they're basically a whole separate office that handles all the outgoing proposal stuff, every bit of it. So it's the greatest invention ever. Okay, so if you have something like that on your campus, utilize it. So here's sort of the process that I've gotten sort of down to in terms of all this is sort of called the idea. I call it the idea loop, and basically which is first the idea of the RFP. And actually, I've decided the idea. You have ideas now of stuff you want to work with, right? I mean, you're coming out of a postdoc or grad school or someplace. You've got some idea of something you want to do, and that's really the first step in this whole process is to get that idea out there. So don't wait. Start writing your ideas out. Start getting your ideas down on paper, on electrons, if you will, in the machine, and wait for the new RFPs will be out, and you can use them in there. Start out being flexible on your ideas and what you're going to do with them. Gather information, get input, attend meetings, read, review stuff. Reviewing stuff is a great way of getting new ideas and new techniques. I review for environmental science and technology all the time, and that is just the best thing in terms of new stuff that's coming down in terms of approaches. Talk to others, okay? Talk, go around and see people, talk to them about your ideas. Serve on review panels if you get asked, state or federal, do that. And get outside your normal comfort zone. So read a few things that aren't really in your comfort zone. I mean, I think most schools have this, but we have this access to just about every journal there is now via some negotiations that the university library has done. You can get all kinds of odd things and interesting things delivered right to your computer on your desktop in terms of there. The other critical thing in this diagram here is preliminary data. And I can't overemphasize the importance of preliminary data in a proposal. Okay? If there's one thing that I've seen after reviewing, I don't know, a couple, maybe 400 or 500 proposals in my life, is that proposals with preliminary data tend to do a lot better than ones without. Okay, and I'll explain ways of getting around the fact you may not have preliminary data, but you can make it look like you do. Preliminary data empowers your ideas. Okay, if you have an idea and you collect a little preliminary data on it, you're a lot better off showing a graph that says, oh, look, this idea I had, this is what we did, this is sort of part of the result we got. That's a really powerful thing to include in a proposal. And the thing I say of it to especially the new faculty is that if you get startup funds, use some of that to generate preliminary data. All right? You know, you're going to have to buy stuff, I realize. You know, you're going to have to do that. You're going to have to outfit labs. You're going to have to, you know, buy whatever you buy. But use some of that to generate preliminary data on your ideas. It's really critical. That really helps the proposal a lot. I also think that, I think this statement is actually even more true anymore, is that the proposal development process should be an intellectual effort equal to writing a paper. Okay, that's how much competition there is now out there for these things. This is no longer just a nice little thing you do one Saturday morning. It's a very strategically developed process. It's really, you got to put some brain power into this stuff and getting it done. Proposals are not the endpoint; they are the means to your academic discovery. They're a tool in your tool bag in terms of what's out there. And proposals make your ideas real. Again, I emphasize that. But it's you've got to use your brain on the proposal, and all the things you know how to do, and all this proposaling skill set you have, you need to develop. It's really important to have all that. So I have all these sort of tips in here, but you need to build a deliberate path to this. The success equals preparation plus the opportunity. The preparation is the preliminary data. It's the thinking about the subject and the ideas. It's maybe writing a literature review on a topic before you actually write the proposal. It's all this stuff is there. Preparation is not always obvious. If you're thinking and reviewing and reading, you're preparing. Collaborators are not always obvious. You're talking to people. Okay, then you're sort of developing a collaborator then. You never stop learning, and thinking is an important activity. And this is the part that gets lost, and it's lost right now in my life. But it's spending time thinking about your science and what you want to go with it, and what you want to do with it. It's really critical, and it's blocking an hour out in the morning to review a paper or to write some stuff down or to do a couple little things related to a proposal. That's a really good activity to keep your thinking powers going. And when you're in grad school and a postdoc, you may have a little more time to do this kind of stuff. But when you get into the faculty into this, you got to teach a class or two classes, and you got to do extension programs, and you got to do this or that, or this or that, or this or that. And all that just sort of gets smeared over your thinking time. So here's a early career-ish thing to do, and I did this, and it worked out really well. Think nationally about a problem, but propose locally, okay? On your campus, there will be all kinds of programs. There should be all kinds of programs for new investigators. I mean, a lot of schools have usually support a grad student kind of dollars available. So internal programs are really critical. Don't overlook getting a $25,000 internal grant. You think, oh, that's not very much money. Well, actually, it's a lot of money, and it can go a lot of ways, a long way, in terms of building a preliminary data set and publications. Okay, so if your university has support for grad students that you can apply for, or travel grants, or anything like that, apply. It does two things. One, it gives you money, and two, on your resume, it now says you received a grant, okay, as a new investigator. That's critical. When the promotion tenure committee looks at your document, they just sort of look at that list of stuff that's on there in terms of things you applied for and gotten, and that's really important. And then we actually on our promotion tenure committee look at it and say, have they applied for those things? Well, those were available. Why didn't they apply? So we know what's available, and we know that they missed it. So that's sort of you get double whammy there. You didn't get the money, then you get criticized for it. So do apply for the internal. Think nationally. Get your program ideas going nationally. You know you want to apply for a NIFA grant, you know, next year, let's say, for example, and you know that there's internal money that you can apply for this year at your school. Don't do two separate projects. Okay, that's another problem. Sort of build this continuum of ideas towards a bigger grant, right? So you can build something locally you can get a local project, you can get a student, you can get some preliminary data going, then you can apply for the federal program. I've had a number of colleagues over the years who have sent out like six different grant proposals, I mean completely different things, to different agencies. And I'm like, why don't you try to maybe narrow that down to at least three? I mean, that's plenty, three different things. Or try to find some linkage between all those ideas so that you can sort of cross feed on them. Use your publications, okay? Anything you write or anything you propose, use your publications. Cite yourself in your proposal. There is no better chance than using your own publications, okay? This says two things. One, it says you published, and the reviewers will look at that. Reviewers don't always look at the CVs very carefully, but if you've got a publication that you can work into the method section or into the front part of the proposal, that's a really good idea, and you can cite yourself. You say, in our work, boom, you did this work. That becomes two things. It becomes your ability to use your publication to show your abilities. It's also preliminary data that's not really preliminary data. It's sort of semi-preliminary data then, because you've published it already. It's not really preliminary. But for the proposal's sake, it shows you can do the work, which is basically what preliminary data is. And this sort of self-citation is a really good type of preliminary data. The other thing I would emphasize is, if you guys don't know about it, and that's why I stuck it sort of in the middle of this, is that you should learn about the H-index, which is this little way of ranking publications over through your career. You should take a look at that. It's on the internet. You can figure it out. But it's getting used more and more, and I suspect at some point in time it's going to get lumped into the proposal review process. I just have this feeling. It's just too easy to use, and so I think it's going to come along at a point. So you need to look at that. The other thing that's really important about the H-index, it's sort of overlooked, is the fact that it's based on your name, okay? So it's your first name, your middle initial, and your last name is how they run this thing. And if you start changing those around, it affects the H-index scoring, and it becomes more difficult to figure it out. So you should write your name the same in all your publications. In other words, in my case, it's R. I don't usually use my middle name, but all my publications is R.F. Turco now, right? That's always what they say, because on this citation system, it picks up the middle initial as sort of a code thing. So pick a descriptive of your name and use it forever, is what I'm trying to tell you. It's worth considering, because it helps in this sort of indexing kind of thing, and people can find you that way. Just decide what you want to do and do it forever. That's basically doesn't matter what it is, just decide. So what reason we care about all this stuff is, this is sort of out of a proposal. This is sort of saying what's going on out there. So demonstrates accuracy and description, demonstrates feasibility to preliminary data and or postdoctoral fellowship publication record or of the mentor. So this is sort of the kind of thing that the agencies look for in the application. So you need to get that preliminary data in there. You need to get your publications in there. You need to get that information about you being able to do the project into the proposal. They ask for it. You've got to show it. So it's all the other stuff they ask for: qualifications of project personnel, adequacy of facilities, etc. This is all out of proposals, RFPs. So you should sort of think about your life as it moves out. You should think about sort of 5 years out. I know, which is hard to do. The kind of grants and gradients, the gradients and drivers you want to work through, disciplinary work. Do you want to do short and long-term projects? Do you want to do basic to applied research questions? I don't like that. I don't like that split, but it exists. Individual and team projects and scheduling. You got to start scheduling. I mean, this is all it's all tough to do, but it's out there. And you need to know the major due dates for the RFPs that are coming along. You need to know the funding cycles, and you need to sort of embed them in your annual plan of work. So you're thinking about what you're doing next year. Oh, when is NIFA going to be due? Or when's the NIH going to be due? Or when's what's going to be due? Get them on your calendar so you can sort of work backwards the kind of timeline you want to put together. We do that. It works okay. At least you're aware of what you missed. Other things I suggest, and this doesn't get mentioned too often, but there are a number of books around on this very topic in terms of your early career at the helm, a laboratory navigator, sort of how to run a lab. advice to a young scientist, proposal and planning and writing. Those are all, there's lots of books on this stuff. The internet's loaded up with stuff on proposal writing. The federal government gives classes on it. A lot of universities give classes on this, right? I mean, your schools will have a proposal workshop somewhere along the line. You should look into this stuff. I mean, again, the way what I'm trying to emphasize on all this is that don't discount the importance of doing this. And it's, again, it's just like learning any other skill. It's a grant skill. It's like learning how to, I mean, in my case, I'm a little far down the line to learn too many new things, but I've learned a lot of genetic techniques over the last few years, PCR, all this other stuff that I had to learn because that was what's required by federal agencies for the kind of work I do now. So I had to learn all that stuff. Well, you have to learn how to do grant skills. You have to learn how to do this stuff. You have to learn all the tricks and you have to do it to learn it. It's an on-the-job experience kind of thing. So that's the kind of skill set that's there. Okay, I got this. I had a couple summary. I have a couple stop points in this talk because it's a little long and people tend to leave. I want to make sure if you have questions early on, you can ask them. Summary one here is good idea, be realistic, clear and simple, easy to read. We'll come back to that. Define your group and abilities and a real budget, carefully justify it. Okay. Don't think, I've seen some amazing budgets over the years in terms of what people think they can get for in a grant. But so that's a summary one. So I'll just stop right now. Anybody have any quick questions for the first bunch of stuff? Yeah. That's tricky because it depends on the agency and it depends on. His question is if you get the grant as a postdoc, is it transferable? Is that correct? I think that most postdocs, at least the ones I'm aware of, are transferable by definition. I think it's in the language of the RFP. It says that. So look through it. The easiest thing to do is to look through the RFP and see what it says. It'll say something about that, especially for postdoc ones. And then write the federal agency and ask them. Program managers, and there's a bunch here from AFRI today, are the most helpful people around. Okay? Do not fear a program manager. Their job is to give out money. That's what they do for a living. Okay? They want to give it out to people who do work and who will follow through. Okay? That's the review part. They will work with you. Don't ask them, don't badger them. And whatever you do, and this is, I have this later on, if you get rejected, don't call them up and yell at them. It's not their fault. Okay? It's not their fault. And they will remember you. If you yell at them, they remember who you are. And they'll figure out some way to screw you later. No, that's it's a review process that they manage, they don't control. Okay? So program managers are people who want to help you. We've been working with one. We have a huge application out right now. It's massive amounts of money, and our program manager, the guy who runs the panel, has been nothing but helpful on how to little things, big things, all kinds of stuff. They want to award funds. That's their job. That's how they get promoted. That's how they get kudos where they are. Is to award grants. They want to help you with that. So check the RFP, see what it says, and then write the agency person, whoever's indicated there, and ask them specifically if I change jobs. That way you have it in writing. So email is great because it gives you a writing record of things. And if it's some kind of specific question like that, that's good to get written down. Other questions? Yeah. So in terms of the review process or in terms of promotion? Review process is fine. It's not an issue with review process. It's actually okay at the review process. Promotion, it's okay. You'll get a little chiding for it in the review process. If you get awarded, people are going to kind of overlook that. The key on that is to actually produce some publications pretty quickly. You get the money, the co-PI is a major person. That's fine. You got money, right? Get the papers out. And then that whole problem goes away. That whole question of who did what goes away. So, yeah.
Do you think that's becoming more or less beneficial
Give me an example. We have a bunch of subcontracts in the grants with industry on stuff we've been doing. The bioenergy area. There's lots of folks who do product development, and we're actually providing them support on a couple of ours. I mean, we feed money through to them. We think it reviewed really well. It showed a really practical output from the project. So I would have maybe 5 years ago wouldn't have said that, but I think the businesses have changed and their model has changed, and I think it's turned into a pretty good relationship. I think it reviews pretty well. Aaron? Well, you go to the AFRI meeting at 10 o'clock and you tell the panel manager people there that you want to be on a review panel, hand them a card. Okay, and then there's an open call on the NIFA and NSF website for potential reviewers. You sign up for that. And then when the calls come out, you're not going to apply, send the program manager an email and say you wouldn't mind being a reviewer. Being on a review panel is kind of a funny experience. It's a lot of work. Okay, you'll get some huge number of proposals to review, but then you see all kinds of proposals. You see the process on the inside. You sit in the panel room for 2 days. You hear the discussions. You hear what people look for. You hear all that stuff. Okay, and it's a really good experience. You don't always get put on the review panel the first time you ask, but keep asking. Especially on these, what happened this year was they had these really big calls out, and they ran out of reviewers because of so much conflict. So that was kind of an interesting situation. But again, at 10 o'clock or whenever it is, there's a NIFA people will be around. Mike O'Neill does water quality. Ray Knightenden does soil and carbon. Mike Bowers does ecosystems work. I don't know if they're all here, but those are the kind of people you need to talk to if you want to be on one of those panels. Just send me an email. It's pretty straightforward. Any other questions? Sorry, I flipped the button before I looked. Okay. Collaborative grants. I switched this around. I used to talk about the individual grant proposal first, but just in terms of time, I decided to go through collaboratives a little bit quicker, earlier in the process, because they are such a big deal now. Everybody wanted this, and now we have it. Okay? And I sort of say, NIFA, it's a new day. Because it's a big new deal. More people, more meetings, less money. So this is sort of the proposal mixture that's there. Okay, you have proposals with many PIs, few PIs, you, them, us, and it's sort of a mixture. And your promotion package, you'll need to have a mixture of proposal types. You can be on big projects, that's not a problem, but you really ought to have a couple of individual-ish PI projects of your own. That really helps the whole promotion process. And when I say your own, I'm talking about two PIs. Rare do you see a single PI proposal anymore. There's usually always at least a couple people involved. That's basically a small proposal anymore. When I first got out of grad school and started doing this, most proposals were one PI, and a multiple PI proposal was two. Now multiple PI proposals are 40, 30, 20, that kind of range. Huge logistics and management issues. So it's a mixture. It's a mixture sort of in how you get the money. It's a mixture in how you use it as on part of your promotion process. It's sort of this cycle. Don't think you need to have all one or the other, but a mixture is probably the best way to go. Most projects are collaborative to some degree. You usually have at least one other PI on a project with you just to have somebody to talk to about it. That really helps. You need to sort of think about collaborative projects. How many different collaborators do you want to have? And early on in your career, if you can find somebody to work with and you guys get along good, stick with them. I had a colleague of mine that I worked with for years that we did a lot of stuff together, and it worked out great because I knew what he could do, he knew what I could do, and then that just was a good mix. I've got that relationship with some other people now. Same thing. It's just nice. They do their part. I do my part. They kind of come together pretty cleanly. So the new NIFA model pushes collaborative projects to a whole different level, okay? And that's their intent. Clean and simple. They wanted that to happen. They're termed integrated projects, which are basically collaborative projects, and this is a really tricky little equation they threw in there, which has caused us any number of a bit of grief in terms of what it really means until we actually talked to a program manager. We called them up and said, okay, what do you want in this section? And they clarified it a bit, but integrated programs have a research component, extension component, and education component. And they're serious about this. All right, so you have to at least have two out of the three components, research, education, or extension, in an integrated project. And you can't have more than two-thirds of the budget going to one component. So basically, you can't have 99% of the money going to a research and then 1% going off to some alleged education project. So you actually have to build a proposal physically around this breakdown. So two-thirds, one-third, if you're going to propose that, that's about how the pages should be allocated in the proposal as well. We have a project right now. It's basically a little more than a third research. It's got a little less extension than an education component in it. The proposal is structured that way, page limit-wise. We actually wrote it that way. We set it up and wrote it that way. Budgeted it that way. Peopled it that way. And it's in the review process right now. And so we're moving along in the review process. So you need to think about that. When it says integrated programs, take it seriously. They look for it. So the NIFA plan, and you can hear about it all officially at 10 o'clock, but fewer, this will not be good news to you, I can tell you right now. It wasn't good news to me, and because I like NIFA money. I like USDA money. Fewer small individual investigator grants. More large awards, okay? It's hard on new professors, I'll just be honest with you. So what's going to have to happen is we're going to have, as the reviewers for promotion and tenure, we've got to have to shift our lens a little bit on how we evaluate, in my opinion. So in 2008, NIFA funded 303 standard research grants. This year, and that's a small, basically two PIs, okay? So this year they expect to fund 130 to 150 individual investigator grants. Cut it in half. Took all that money and put all that money into bigger projects. Okay, that's the NIFA plan. And it's going to get worse before it sort of settles down. So to answer your question about co-PIs and bigger projects, that's sort of the world you're going to have to aim at anyway. So I think promotion packages will get looked at differently because of this kind of thing. NIFA, again, if you go to the NIFA meeting, you'll hear all the details on why all this is. They have set this up under five sort of pillars of what they're after. Keep America agriculture competitive, ending world hunger, improve nutrition, end childhood obesity. These are pretty broad things. Radically improve food safety for all Americans, secure America's energy future through renewable biofuels. Number four is a big target for lots of people in agronomy. Okay, you got soils, you got plants, you got water, you got nutrition, you got all kinds of nutrients, all kinds of things. And then you got mitigate and adapt agriculture to variations in climate. So between 3, 4, and 5, there's plenty of space for things that traditional things we do in agriculture. It seems daunting what they've done, but it's actually had some big openings for us in terms of kind of research projects. So when you look at these big targets, how many collaborators do you need? You need to develop your extramural portfolio. So in your promotion document, you need to think about this. You need to think about these large projects. You need to think about small research projects. You need to sort of go, I would suggest you go with smaller research projects initially, specifically look on campus and in college, go after those things, start building up your ideas, start looking at multiple PI projects, a couple, three people, and then in 4 or 5 years, you're ready to be part of one of these big collaborative projects. If you have a specific set of skills, this is sort of an interesting adaptation to this, specific set of skills that you know how to do, something that your collaborator friends on campus want, you can be brought into one of these big projects as a co-PI and actually contribute very little time to possibly getting a lot of money if you have a specific set of skills that somebody wants. Okay, so be out there looking for that advantage. You do something, I mean, the big areas that I'm aware of are modeling. Most of these projects require a lot of modeling. These big guys do. If you have specific, like if you're a big use, unless make sure, if you get brought, Well, yeah, maybe. This works. We do this. You need at least a large amount of room for it. I sort of had this proposal writing as a lifestyle.
Use that for future planning, a future.
They may want to support a few small things.